Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to the Irish Times Women's Podcast. I'm Cathy Sheridan. Now, in today's episode, we will be hearing about a really worthy campaign that is being run by the Irish Cancer Society. It's called Leave Our Leave, and it focuses on the 60 women per year in Ireland who receive a cancer diagnosis during or just after their pregnancy and who are not able to defer their maternity leave during this period. So it's sick leave as opposed to maternity leave.
Like, I couldn't, my arms were so sore, I couldn't hold my baby. I could not, I remember my mum coming in, that was one of the hardest days. She brought him in for a cuddle, he was only like maybe like 7 or 8 weeks old, and she handed him to me, and I was like, I can't, I was lying in the bed, I was like, I can't physically hold him. So in what way is that maternity leave? You know, that's, it was just horrific, you know.
That was Emma McGuinness there, who was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma while pregnant with her second child and was unable to defer her maternity leave. We'll be hearing more from Emma later. But first, have you ever walked past the Molly Malone statue in Dublin and observed how tourists pose beside her while groping her breasts? It's become a tradition for those who visit her. And there's one young woman who had enough of this mockery of our beloved Molly. Her name is Tilly Cripwell, and she's a student at Trinity College Dublin. She's also a busker who regularly plays music beside the statue. And each day she watches on as groups approach poor Molly and grope her on her breasts. Tilly has launched the Leave Molly Malone campaign so that people will stop reducing her to something to objectify, deride and mock, to quote Tilly. She joined Roisin Ingle on the podcast this week to talk about why she has set up this campaign and what she tells people who say, oh, come on, it's just a statue. Here she is, Tilly Cripwell.
Tilly, you are on a mission to stop people from groping the Molly Malone statue, which I think is very admirable. So tell me, why did you start this Leave Molly Malone campaign?
Yeah, so I started it because I spend a lot of time busking by the statue every week. I spend around 8 to 10 hours busking a week. So a lot of that is by the statue. It's one of my favourite spots. And when I'm busking, I have a lot of thinking time. I'm standing there and waiting for money or if they give it to me or not. And I just kept thinking, why are people laughing at the statue? Why are they going up to her and touching her inappropriately, behaving inappropriately around her? And I was thinking, wait, this is one of the few female Irish national icons that exists. And yet she's being reduced to something that's not iconic, but rather just an object of harassment and objectification. And I came home one Sunday after busking. I'd been by the statue for a couple of hours. And I just said to my flatmates, I can't stand it on any longer. Not only is it mortifying for the statue, but it also is really disruptive when I'm busking because I hear all this laughter and this supposed bravado going on. And I just got really cross and decided I was going to launch a campaign. And then the Leave Molly Malone name kind of just came to me very aptly at that time.
So what did you do? Did you start to confront people when you were busking about what they were doing?
Yes. However, firstly, that can be quite terrifying and quite disruptive to my busking as well, which isn't really the object. So what I did is I put out an Instagram post of me busking by the statue. I put in a long caption explaining my main reasons for starting the campaign and why it was needed. And I got in touch with Imelda May and Cat O'Driscoll, who's Dublin City Councillor for Art and Culture, because I'd seen that they'd supported the movement in the past. And I got in touch with a couple of newspapers, not loads. I kind of thought that they would just ignore me, all of them. But what happened is that the initial Instagram post and that initial movement created this big stir. And so I didn't put in that much groundwork, but actually lots of people caught on to it, especially with it coinciding with Paddy's Day and International Women's Week. And so the campaign kind of did the work itself.
Tell us about the groping of the statue, because it is groping. And I know it's only a statue. It's an inanimate object. There's no real woman being hurt in the process of this. But at the same time, it's symbolic of the way women are treated, I think. The Molly Malone statue, I think, unfortunately, when it was put up in 1988, has very, you know, breasts that are very exposed. And that's part of the whole thing. I don't think if that statue was made now, it would be done the same. And it was actually made by a woman, we should mention as well. But what are people doing to the statue? And what's the kind of tradition that has become kind of accepted in a way?
I mean, the main thing that I see is, well, yeah, people touching her breasts, people groping her breasts, and then more inappropriate behaviour, like people kissing her breasts, kissing her face, just generally what seems to me like taking advantage of a woman because, well, she can't do anything about it, can she? And it is just most crushing when I see this and there are kids watching. And for example, the other day I saw a woman encouraging her daughter, who was about six, to touch the statue's boobs. And the daughter turned around and looked really embarrassed and kind of just shook her head and wouldn't do it. And I thought, that's her innocence. That's her moral compass coming through because she hasn't been corrupted by a patriarchal society yet. And that is her innocence coming through and telling her, no, I'm embarrassed. Why am I embarrassed? It was a subconscious thing for her, but it got me thinking about it more.
Now, if we go down to Oscar Wilde in Merrion Square, I imagine you haven't been busking there necessarily, but have we seen people growing up and grabbing Oscar's crotch or kissing Oscar or doing any similar things to him?
No, not at all. And I walk past the Oscar Wilde statue every day as well, and I never see that kind of behaviour.
And why is that, do you think?
Because he's a man. I think a lot of people as well see Molly Malone's allegedly busty dress as a kind of green light to go ahead and touch her. But actually, if women are wearing what people think are busty dresses in the street, that still doesn't give men a right to go up and touch them. It's just no kind of justification.
And the statue itself has actually been discoloured now. If you think about it, damage has been caused to the bronze statue because of the amount of rubbing and groping that goes on. They're different colour, aren't they, the breasts, than the rest of the statue?
Yeah, and what I find really shocking is that when I was reading up about the statue, I saw that she was obviously moved in 2014. And when she was being moved, she was restored. So the rest of her body was kind of lacquered and re-tarnished, but they actually left her breasts to show that there was that kind of discoloration. So what a lot of people have said to me is, oh yeah, it's bad because it's clearly damaging the statue. But the damage, the physical damage to the statue is not the issue, because if it were, then they would have restored all of her back in 2014.
But I wonder why they didn't restore it then.
I think because it is just a tradition to touch her breasts and they wanted to keep that going, I guess.
So that was almost like a sort of a tacit kind of acceptance of what people are doing, instead of saying, well, look, this is wrong, let's get it back to its former glory and maybe try to discourage people from doing that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's acceptance and encouragement as well.
So when you've gone to people like the cultural officer and, you know, Imelda May, what kind of response did you get? You've obviously had a lot of support, because I read an article that Ellen wrote that was written in the Irish Times. She interviewed people who were passing the statue and what they thought of it. I mean, it has kind of got good wind behind it, hasn't it, what you're trying to do?
It does. And like I said, the campaign has kind of just spoken for itself. And yeah, a lot of people have latched onto it. A lot of people don't like it, which I'm used to. And that's part of the whole process. But it's kind of thinking why it's wrong and actually questioning it in the first place rather than blindly following this tradition.
Mm. So is it going to stop, do you think? I mean, have you seen any difference? Like, are people, you said that it's hard to interrupt your busking by confronting people, but sometimes I suppose you do. What kind of response do you get when you ask people not to do that to Molly Malone?
A lot of people agree, both men and women, and I see them showing their support. They'll kind of nod at me when I'm saying these things, especially, well, I did a big day of busking when I had organisations coming along with me who were helping me out with the campaign. And a lot of people were watching and they really supported it, which is really encouraging. I also last weekend went out and was just informally saying to people, because it was on International Women's Day, I said, please, it's International Women's Day. If there's one day for us to not touch Molly's breasts, it's today. A lot of people were like, okay, fair enough. A couple of people, I said, there was a woman encouraging her children to touch the statue's breasts. And I said, no, don't touch her breasts. It's International Women's Day. It sets a bad example. And she got quite wound up by that because she thought that I was saying you're raising your children wrong, which I guess in a way is raising children wrong, but it can hit people very sensitively, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on something very important when you mentioned that there's very few statues of women in Ireland and iconic images like that. We have Molly and we have Countess Markievicz. I think we have a couple more. I mean, it would be like someone going down and, you know, making a thing of touching Countess Markievicz's breasts down beside the Irish Times here, actually. It just seems very reductive and misogynistic and kind of old school. And then other people will say, look, Tilly, it's just a statue. Who cares? It's just a bit of a laugh. What do you say to those people?
I say to those people that I get a lot of people saying that it's just a statue. However, the reason we create our statues in the first place is, in some cases, first and foremost, as a form of art, fine. In a lot of cases, we're immortalizing the figures and the icons that are no longer tangible. We can no longer access them. We're continuing their legacy. So in every way, they're symbolic. In every way, they're representative. And in every way, they are not a statue. They're not created to look just like a statue. So why does that kind of rule just end when we want to touch Molly's breasts and she's reduced back to being just a statue when before she's actually a national icon?
And people can hear from your lovely accent that you are not Irish yourself. I know you have a little bit of Irish in you, but you're from Wiltshire in England. I think it's kind of interesting that the person who's become a spokeswoman for Molly is not, in fact, from here. But what is your background in terms of how you came to Ireland?
I'm a student in Trinity College. I'm in my third year of study. And I don't know, I wanted to break out of England, which probably isn't that shocking to you. So I came over here to study languages, and all of the music just fell into place as a result of that.
And you've been doing music for a long time?
Since I was about 10, and I've been busking for about a year and a half on and off.
How do you find the busking climate in Ireland versus England? Have you noticed any difference? Did you do some over there as well?
I've actually never done any busking in England, but obviously Grafton Street is so notorious and it's such a tourist attraction going to Grafton Street and seeing the buskers there. So I love the climate. The busking community is very kind and safe and not competitive at all, which is what a lot of people would expect. So no, I really enjoy it, which is why it would be nice to enjoy it more when I'm by the statue.
Now, you actually sing the song Molly Malone in Dublin's Fair City when you're busking. And I think you bring a whole other life to the song, actually. We're going to hear a little bit of it now so people can see what it is you do.
Now no one can save her from the people who claim her. And I want to scream, just leave Molly alone. Like those with no voice, she's left with no choice.
It's really, really beautiful. Do people respond to the song? Because for some of us who've grown up with it, it's almost a bit of it's background noise, it's cliche. We're so familiar with the song that it's hard to get attached to it. But did you find something very soulful and new in it when you started to look at the song?
I did. And I think especially Sinead O'Connor's version, how she makes it seem really ethereal and kind of almost ghostly, which is exactly what Molly's status represents. And so I wanted to represent that as well and actually tell her story, because I find it funny how there's no plaque or anything that actually tells Molly's story next to the statue. And the song is the only way of doing that.
So are we looking at some kind of, do we need some kind of protective barrier around Molly? What is this sort of a long-term solution to it? But I love your idea of the plaque as well, because at the very least there should be something telling the history and the information about the statue and about Molly herself.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love for there to be both a figurative and a physical barrier, where physical barriers, just because she deserves it, a plaque explaining her story, and for her to be raised on a higher pedestal, and for her to be completely restored so that there is no longer any discoloration on her breasts. But also where it's figurative, where it actually becomes a tradition of shame almost to touch her breasts, and it doesn't become the norm, and where people aren't proud and happy and celebrating when they touch her breasts, but actually it's something that's frowned upon by the people around them.
Mm-hmm. Like we've said, okay, it's only a statue, but do you feel, because I do, that it's representative of the continuing objectification of women, that it's another way that this is acceptable? Like I mentioned Oscar and any other, name any other male statue around the city or the country, you're not getting anybody trying to physically defile the statues in that way and think it's a laugh. But with a woman statue, it's all bets are off and it's all a bit of a laugh. And if you give out about it, you're a prude or there's something wrong with you, you don't have a sense of humour. So do you take that line very much towards the fact that we're still dealing with issues around women, if they want to wear dresses that have short skirts or, you know, whatever, that they're sort of seen as fair game, and that, you know, she's almost, that Molly Malone is asking for it by wearing that dress on her statue.
Yeah, completely. I actually saw, I watched a video yesterday which said if women were really asking for it, they would just ask for it because we can, which is so true. So I think the same with the statue. It is a more sensitive topic, groping a female statue rather than a male statue. Not that it even happens to male statues, except for one in France, that's an exception. That women are a suppressed population, we do face discrimination already. So it is a more sensitive topic when we're talking about a female statue, and it's not equivalent to male statues, especially when there's actually only 5 female statues in Dublin, and lots of them are just not of actual figures who've existed. A lot of them are just like Erin representing Ireland, or general female statues, like the one up by Stephen's Green Shopping Centre.
Or the two women sitting together who have their shopping basket beside them on the Ha'penny Bridge, near the Ha'penny Bridge, yeah.
Exactly. It's not like any proper female figures who've done amazing things are being commemorated, and then you go to O'Connell Street and you get slapped by all of these massive male statues on huge pedestals. So the fact that the most famous female statue in Dublin is being treated this way is a more sensitive topic.
Mm. Leave Molly Malone, it's a genius title. Do you see anything happening? Like, have you got any, made any progress? Are you confident that there will be progress?
Yeah, I hope so. And the Dublin City Councillor, Cat O'Driscoll for Art and Culture, has put forward a movement to get those physical installations put in place that I mentioned and get the statue restored. I think my next port of call would be to talk to the kind of tourist agencies, because obviously there are so many tours coming around saying, oh, the tradition is to rub her boobs. So that would make a massive difference to talk to them. And in general, I have noticed people refraining a bit more just by the statue, which is really encouraging, but it's a work in progress.
I just think, even when you say it, a tradition to rub the breasts of a statue, it just sounds so wrong and bizarre. And is it true that people think it gives them good luck or something?
Yeah, that's the only, well, allegedly the main reason people do it, which I find a bit crazy. And I know that the same happens with the statue of Juliet in Verona. However, I did hear the topic being discussed on the radio the other day as well. And apparently a new message has come out that it's actually 7 years bad luck now to touch a Molly statue, which I'm happy to propagate that rumour a bit more, but I'm not sure where it's come from.
Maybe a little sign on the statue saying 7 years bad luck or something. Has that already happened?
Yeah, exactly. People would believe it.
Okay. And listen, just about you and your music, you're doing languages and you're passionate about music. What other songs do you sing? If people go down to the statue, what can they expect from you?
A few original songs. As you can hear with the Molly Malone song, I'm very passionate about creating meaningful lyrics. So some original songs, Feeling Good by Nina Simone, Ain't No Sunshine, a lot of old classics like that.
Brilliant. Well, Tilly Cripple, I think you're amazing. And I think it's you've done the state some service with your campaign. And I wish you all the best with it. And hopefully there will be some, hopefully people will stop objectifying and mocking Molly Malone, because as you said, we've hardly any women's statues and they should be protected and respected, which is not happening at the moment. So well done for what you're doing and the best of luck with your music career as well. Do you think you'll go into music or languages in the end?
I mean, I'm waiting for a break with the music, so I can't say. That would be the goal, but languages would also be great.
Brilliant. Well, Tilly Cripple, thank you very much for coming on the Women's Podcast.
Thank you so much.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Now, did you know that men can defer their paternity leave if they receive a cancer diagnosis? But women can't. And the Irish Cancer Society wants to change this. In 2022, they launched the Leave Our Leave campaign, which is asking the government to bring in legislation that would allow women to defer their maternity leave if they find themselves in the terrible situation of getting a cancer diagnosis while pregnant or just after birth. Today, I'm joined by cancer survivor Emma McGuinness, who found herself in this exact situation, pregnant with her second child and a cancer diagnosis. She had no option but to use up her maternity leave to undergo chemotherapy. Fun. I'll also be joined by CEO of the Irish Cancer Society, Avril Power, who tells me how this issue is progressing or not through government and why change isn't coming quick enough. Avril, what is the Leave Our Leave campaign?
Well, every week in Ireland, Cathy, a woman is diagnosed with cancer either while pregnant or with a young baby. And as a result, they're separated from their little one while they're in hospital and are often too sick to care for them in the normal way when they're at home. And right now, working mothers can't defer their maternity leave until they're better. So the clock runs on their maternity leave as soon as their little one is born.
Or while they're having treatment.
While they're having treatment. Even if they spend all that time separated or bulk of that time separated from their little one, if they're in hospital recovering from surgery, they're in and out for chemotherapy, radiotherapy, the clock is still running on their mat leave. So they don't get to go on to illness leave, which would be the logical thing. While you're sick, you're on an illness benefit and then afterwards you go on your mat leave. That's not possible. So the clock just runs on their mat leave, and as soon as they're better, they have to go back to work. And that means that sadly they never get the precious bonding time that every mom should have with their young baby. And we think that's incredibly cruel. So that's why we've run this Leave Our Leave campaign. And have teamed up with women who sadly have gone through this experience and worked with them to share their stories and put pressure on government to change this incredibly cruel situation.
Avril, this may be a sort of a left field question. What happens to, men can defer their paternity leave, can't they?
They certainly can. So if a man gets cancer while he's on paternity leave, he can postpone it and take the paternity leave later when he's better. If your child is diagnosed with cancer or is hospitalised while you're on maternity leave, you can postpone it because your child has been hospitalised and you're separated from them. But when the mother herself is in hospital or really sick undergoing cancer treatment, she can't. And that's just, it's nonsensical and it's incredibly cruel.
It really is. Is there a law underpinning this?
So the law for maternity leave is in the Maternity Act. So it is relatively old legislation. I think it's the 2004 Maternity Act. The paternity legislation is more recent. It's the 2016 Paternity Leave and Benefit Act. So we then, when we highlighted this, would have assumed, you know, that it was just an oversight or people wouldn't have thought about it 20 years ago when they were bringing in the maternity legislation. They wouldn't have thought about these scenarios. But they obviously did think about it when they were doing paternity leave. So we thought that once we went out, and once women came forward and bravely shared the really distressing impact that this situation has had on them, the government would change it. But sadly, we've been campaigning on this for 2 years now, and that hasn't happened yet.
You did get support, though. I mean, Radhika Gorman did show willing, and he promised to bring forward legislation. What happened to that?
So, well, we met with the minister last year, with the minister and his officials, and he did listen, and he did, I know he understands how upsetting this is and how unfair it is to women who are affected by it. He then announced in October that he would bring legislation to Cabinet before Christmas, and that he'd go to Cabinet and get commitment to changing this legislation. But as of now, and I guess it's 6 months later, we haven't seen that. So the heads of the bill haven't been published. So we're really worried now, I guess, as we head into the final lap of this government. Yes. I mean, there's only a year at max left, that if that legislation is not published and brought into the Oireachtas as soon as possible, it won't happen in the lifetime of this government. And, you know, every week that passes, another woman has to go through this situation. You're talking about 50, 60 women a year find themselves in this incredibly distressing situation. So on one hand, a relatively small group, and not a big deal for government to change it. But on the other hand, the incredible hurt, distress that this is causing women is just unbelievable.
Importantly, Avril, if this government goes out, the bill dies, if there is a bill. I mean, there isn't a bill yet, but if there was one.
Yeah, if it was halfway through, then the bill would just collapse. If
that's the end
of that. It
hasn't
finished in both the Dáil and the Seanad by the time the election is called. So that's why time is really of the essence here.
Indeed. Emma, good morning to you.
Yes. Good morning.
This is a campaign very close to your heart for very good reasons. It's something you've had direct personal experience of. Can you bring us back to 2021 when you were pregnant with your second child and your mother spotted a lump on your neck?
Yeah. So in January, the end of January 21, my mum said to me, I hope you don't mind me saying it, but she was like, you've got like a lump in your neck. And it presented not like a lump, like it wasn't something I had felt, but it was a swelling on the side of my neck. I made an appointment with my GP, and my husband is actually a GP as well. He had looked at it and kind of was like, okay, we'll get something sorted here quite quickly. I went in for a scan the following week, and from there things started to move really fast. I assumed it was a thyroid issue or something. It never occurred to me that it would be something like cancer.
I was impressed, Emma, that you went about it so quickly, because you had a toddler, you were run ragged, you were back at work. I mean, you were now on maternity leave, but you had been back at work, you were full on, but you nonetheless went to see about this very quickly. Maybe the GP husband was instrumental in that.
Yeah, he knew essentially from the very beginning what it looked like. I was a bit, I just didn't notice, but it was quite large, and I don't know how I didn't notice up until this point. But like you said, I had a toddler, I was tired, it was kind of the early stages of pregnancy, feeling sick and tired anyway. So I just went about doing it. I was like ticking it off. You know, you're kind of taking extra care of yourself when you're pregnant anyway. But yeah, things started to move pretty fast from there. I went for kind of a scan. And then by the end of that week, they had scheduled a biopsy on my neck. And so that was essentially going in for surgery under a general anaesthetic to get it removed. And I got a phone call. That was on the Friday. I got a phone call on the Monday to confirm that it was Hodgkin's lymphoma. So it was such a strange time. Like, it was a complete paradox. I had my 20-week scan the day before I went in for surgery, which was a very routine, you know, appointment.
But also, it's a milestone at the same time. You know, I think that's part of the poignancy of this story, is that all these things that should have been such a joy.
It was a wild roller coaster. Like that 20-week appointment, I didn't say anything about what was happening to me the next day. I just was like, I'm going to try and enjoy this appointment. I was on my own as well because it was COVID times, and looking at this scan of like a healthy baby bouncing around in there, everything looking great, and at the same time having these fears about what was going to happen, you know. So it was wild. And like you said, a real roller coaster. Like when we found out it was a boy then, we were so excited. But at that stage, we had had the cancer diagnosis. So really hard to wrap your head around how we were feeling.
So you had an MRI, Emma, and that showed that it was actually more complicated even. You had more swollen lymph nodes in your neck, two in your chest. And then it became urgent. There was obviously a great sense of urgency around this now. And I presume you saw anxiety in your oncologist's eyes.
Yeah, I must say that everybody was so calm. And I didn't know anybody that this had affected before. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons that I'm very happy to kind of talk about my diagnosis and what I went through and how we've come out the other side. Because at the time I was Googling, I was looking for anybody who had been through the same experience, and I couldn't find anyone. The first woman I spoke to who'd gone through this as well was Erica Tierney, who was like a really important part of this campaign. And to find somebody like her and Mary Canavan at the time, I was just totally blown away, because I was like, this, I didn't think it affected as many women as it does, you know.
And so now it became kind of a race to deliver the baby. Because you needed to start treatment, I presume. Is that how they were thinking? They didn't want to start treatment while you were pregnant? Or tell me about that.
Yeah, so it was all very up in the air. I was going for an appointment every week, and I would have a scan every 3 to 4 weeks to check the spread of the cancer, to see how long we could delay before delivering Rory, and the finish line kept moving. At one stage, it was like, okay, we're going to deliver him at 29 weeks. And then I had my scan and they were like, okay, we can push it to 34. I got to 34 and my gynecologist pushed, our obstetrician pushed to wait an extra 2 weeks. And I am just so grateful to him that we did wait the extra 2 weeks. Because when Rory was born, he was premature. He wasn't ready to be born. He was in NICU for 2 weeks, which at the end of the day isn't, you know, a very long time. You know, there are babies who are in there for a lot longer. But I only had 3 weeks until I started my treatment. So we only had 1 week with Rory at home, 1 week of normality, I suppose, before we were launched into the cancer world. And it's different for everyone. You know, you can very safely have chemotherapy while you're pregnant now. And that was an option for a while. So it's different for everybody, I suppose.
So Rory came home, you started treatment, and what happened next?
So Rory came home the Thursday and I was starting my treatment the following Tuesday, kind of. So we had a few days of normal life. And then, as with anybody who's going into chemo, you just don't know what to expect at all. I had my first chemo session. And after that, I had 12 sessions in total. So over 6 months, I had it every 2 weeks. So my treatment went on for 6 months, and that covered the entirety of my maternity leave.
Because the treatment ended just as your maternity leave was ending. Your maternity leave, quote, unquote, was ending.
My maternity leave ended, I think, 4 days before my last chemo session. So it lasted for the entirety of it. And I suppose that what's so important about this campaign and that this has changed is that at the time, I was so extremely vulnerable. It never occurred to me that I was using up my maternity leave. I mean, you tell me to jump, I'd say how high. I was just doing everything that people told me to do, because I was like, we just need to get through this and get out the other side. And it never occurred to me that how unjust that was until I had heard Erica Tierney talking about the campaign, and we know each other through my cousin. So I got chatting to her, and it was only at that point when I was out the other side, I kind of realised how unfair.
It was only then you realised you'd used up your maternity leave.
I just
that must have been delightful.
Yeah, it was lovely. And at that, at that point, like, you know, I was the sickest I had been throughout the whole thing. You know, when I was giving birth to Rory, I felt fine, and when I was pregnant, I felt fine. But you go through that treatment, and it wears you down gradually
because it's cumulative, isn't it? It builds in your body.
Builds in your body, and so you come out the other side, and you're way worse off. Well, you feel way worse off than you were going into it, you know. And it was then at that point when I was kind of feeling the worst, I was the most tired and like really sick, that then you're hit with all these forms from work and stuff to go on sick leave when you're not in active treatment anymore. I no longer had a diagnosis of Hodgkin's lymphoma, so when filling out these forms, you're having to list out all these side effects and stuff. And because you no longer have that diagnosis, it's not as straightforward to go on sick leave.
Also, Emma, I don't think a lot of people realise that when your treatment ends, that actually you go through a very strange phase of those side effects. And it's also psychological. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I suppose physically, I felt the worst I had ever felt. I was... It's really unwell, you know, kind of loads of recurring infections and stuff like that. But you don't have the, you know, I was so lucky that I had amazing nurses and doctors and stuff around me while I was on treatment. And once you finished, that's gone. You don't have your nurse every week who's coming to check your bloods and stuff like that. So you're kind of living in a heightened, like, awareness of everything that you're feeling, like, could this be back? And you know, but you don't have the safety net of those doctors and nurses around you. You feel very, well, I felt very much like isolated and alone, you know, and your routine of going in every 2 weeks on the Tuesday is gone. You're not meeting the same people anymore. So that was a really difficult time, I must say. And it was that it took me by such surprise, you know.
Yeah. Yes, because you're obviously you're a self-starter. You're a vibrant woman used to getting up early in the morning. Now you have your little girl who is now, what, 3?
Yeah, maybe? She was 3.
Was now at that stage. And little Rory, who is now, what, 6 months?
6 months old, yeah.
So you have 2 children and you're trying to fill in these 2,000-page forms.
Yes,
to say,
exactly.
Well, this is what I have and this is what's wrong with me.
Yeah, and being asked really direct questions like, why can't you work? Like, what are the physical reasons that you cannot work? And I suppose I was kind of like, oh gosh, why can't I? You know, you're kind of like, I suppose I could go back. You know, you're kind of, well, that's the kind of person I am. I'm like, geez, maybe I could, you know. And when I think about what I was going through at the time, like, it was so difficult to have such a small baby and to be out the other side and you're given the good news that, you know, you're okay. But it's only then you start to process everything that you've been through.
Absolutely, yes. And meanwhile, people are thinking, well, she doesn't have cancer and she's 2 lovely kids.
Yeah.
What's up with her?
Exactly,
Yes. So meanwhile, you have this, what I think you've described, you had the chemo brain and the baby brain, and you're filling out all these forms.
Oh my gosh.
And you're also shocked to your boots at the idea that you have no maternity leave. So what happened next?
Absolutely. Well, like I had said, I had been chatting to Erica Tierney, and then she had told me that they were launching the campaign, put me in touch with the girls at the Irish Cancer Society, and we all went up to Dublin that day. And I suppose that was when things really kicked off, and we were so hopeful at the time, April. We were all so excited and we were like, oh yeah, we'll get this done pretty quickly. And I remember at the time my hair was so short, it had only just started growing back, and now, well, my hair is not down now, but I am measuring the length of this campaign by the length of my hair, because it is going on that long now. I've got a full head of long hair now.
And Emma, let's just talk a bit about the financial side of it. Now, you were lucky, I think, because you had an employment protection scheme from work.
We did, yeah. But not everybody is that lucky. Yeah. And I was so hyper aware of that. Like, we were so lucky in so many different ways. You know, my cancer was treatable, first of all. You know, that was brilliant. We were in the position that my parents could move in with us. So, you know, we saved lots of money on, like, what we would have needed, loads of additional childcare. We would have needed, like, a night nurse for the baby and stuff like that, because there was no way I could stay up at night to look after him. So my mum and dad took over that. My mum was sleeping in with my daughter, Grace, because she doesn't like to sleep on her own. And my dad was sleeping with the baby every night because my husband had work every day. So we were so privileged, you know, that we didn't have to, you know, fork out there. Additionally, for driving over and back to the hospital, for going to all these different appointments, and just, like, I suppose part of the amazing work that the Irish Cancer Society does that maybe doesn't get picked up as much as other things is the advocacy stuff. And, you know, they were really instrumental in abolishing the inpatient charges and stuff like that. But, you know, all of that stuff at the time really added up. And I suppose I was lucky I had the insurance scheme in my work. So I was getting some money from there. But, you know, if you're not working, or if your employer doesn't have that, you know, you are kind of forced to go back to work sooner than you would normally have, I would say.
Yes. Because interestingly, I didn't realise this, Emma, because I'm sort of way beyond childbearing years, thank God. But there is very little difference between sick leave and maternity pay.
Yeah, no, it's very little. I can't remember exactly what it is now, but it's very little. And when you're on the sick pay, you're kind of keep having to prove that you were not ready yet, which is a really difficult thing to have to do. And the emotion and the guilt and everything that's tied up in that is really difficult, because any mothers that I know are the hardest workers. Do you know what I mean? And they're so hard on themselves. They'll push themselves to the absolute max to do what's best for their family and do what they feel they should be doing. And I suppose the emotions that are tied up in that are just so difficult to face. And yeah. I think a really important part of this as well is that for lots of us who go through that treatment, we're faced with infertility afterwards. So that maternity leave is oftentimes the last maternity leave you'll ever be able to take, and you're not able to enjoy it. You know, you're not able to use the time like you should be using it, looking after your baby and bonding with your baby. So I suppose that's an additional.
Is that inevitable, Emma, infertility after this treatment?
No, not for everybody. But I suppose, and my doctor has said he wouldn't, if I wanted to try to do that again, you know, he would encourage me to do so and not let this stop me. But after what I went through, like, there is no way I would take that gamble again, to be honest. You know, and even to think about the possibility of it, it would be lovely. I would love to have a small baby to enjoy again. But, you know, the fear that it wouldn't work out and you've kind of started to look forward to it or something. You know, I just want to enjoy the two children that I have. And I mean, how lucky am I who's able to come away with my husband this week for a few days by ourselves. And so we're just focusing on, yeah.
Yeah, tell us where you are.
I'm in Costa Deja in Tenerife this week on a childless few days. So we are great advertisement for life after cancer, for sure.
Well, we're all delighted to hear that, Emma. And I'm very moved by your story, because obviously at the heart of it is you missed those precious, precious early months with Rory. And you were stuck with this awful bureaucracy.
Yeah.
At a time when you really weren't able for it.
Absolutely not. Like I said, it had never even occurred to me. I was focusing on getting through every day. That was it. Nothing outside of our little bubble was even entering my mind.
So, Avril, the idea of actually labelling maternity leave as sick leave, under any circumstances is just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of maternity leave is to give mums that time with their little babies. And I have to say, I find it very upsetting personally to listen to Emma, you know, as the mum of a young child myself. Like, it's such a beautiful time when her child is born, but also a difficult enough time in its own right. You know, you've just met this little person, you're trying to figure out what they need, why are they crying, are they hungry, do they have a dirty nappy, like, are they sick, what's going on with them? And it's a really anxious time in its own right. And it's so important that as a mum that you get that time, that you've time when you're just focusing on your baby. Yes. You know, you're getting over it, pregnancy, which again can be difficult in its own right, recovering from the pregnancy itself, but that you have that time to bond with your little one. You'll never get that again. And to have that, you know, those precious few months robbed by cancer is bad enough, but to add to that the government effectively robbing you of your maternity leave and never giving you that time, even if it is a few months later, I just think is incredibly cruel. And it can't be justified. And also to think that, you know, in the time since that has happened to Emma, and she has bravely shared her story, and Erica and Mary as well, as part of our campaign, you know, that another woman every week is going through that, that this week somebody is in one of our hospitals getting that news. It's just incredibly upsetting, I have to say. I wish we didn't have to keep sharing. And I'm so grateful to Emma for sharing this story, because she could put this behind her and focus on her family. But she's sharing this story, you know, time and again for us, talking about one of the most distressing things that's happened to her. And I think that's really brave. But I also hope, Emma, that it's the last time you have to do that, because I don't think it's fair.
Thank you so much, April. Yeah, you've been so supportive throughout the whole thing. And like I said, I'm always so happy to talk about it, even though it is difficult to go back into it. You know, you're kind of, when you start thinking about the realities of it, where just when you were speaking there about that, like, my arms were so sore, I couldn't hold my baby. I remember my mum coming in, that was one of the hardest days. She brought him in for a cuddle. He was only maybe 7 or 8 weeks old. And she handed him to me, and I was like, I can't. I was lying in the bed, I was like, I can't physically hold him. So in what way is that maternity leave? You know, it was just horrific, you know. Sorry, I just thought of that there. But April, thank you so much. You're just always so supportive and so nice. And you just are so empathic, and I appreciate
Emma,
you so
when you
much.
Talk about sore arms, is that from cannulas and blood drawing and everything?
I had, the chemo was going in through my arms, my hands and my arms every 2 weeks, and that build up. That vein burn, I had that incredibly, it was incredibly tough. That was actually the hardest, the most painful part of it was my hands and my arms, you know. And I work with computers, like I work for a tech company. So that was a huge part of what kind of kept me off for so long, was the pain in my hands, you know.
And these are things that no one thinks about until it's pointed out to them. They think of chemo. You sit there and you have the thing in your arm and you look like somebody in a movie. But in fact, there's all those what they call cancer tales that come after. Avril, the current government is coming to the end of their term, sooner or later. Could be May, could be November, could be whenever. Tell us again what stage we're at with it.
So we haven't even seen the heads of the bill yet. So in terms of the legislative process, usually the heads come for agreement. So that's the kind of the key categories, the main parts of the bill, the key points. They go to government first for approval. And then once those are approved, then the draftsman will go off and actually draft the full piece of legislation. Then that needs to get put on the legislative programme to go into the Dáil and the Seanad. It needs to go through both houses, several stages in both houses. It'll have to go through a committee of the Oireachtas. So there's a whole load of steps that need to be gone through before the legislation will actually be changed. And that's why literally we just get more and more anxious by the day that it won't happen in the lifetime of this government if it's not done straight away.
And what do you think is delaying it?
To be honest, I honestly don't know. I mean, the minister said to us that he's looking at that there are a number of changes that they want to make to equality legislation, family leave legislation, so it's part of a package. Now, he has said to us more recently that if the full package can't be agreed, that he is minded to break it out on its own and do it separately. And we really feel that now we're at the point when that needs to happen, because otherwise it just can't and won't be done in time.
But Avril, you think the process, and you have been in there, you've been a senator, you have sat in there and been...
I've been on the other side.
You have.
So another issue that's very close to my heart is adoption rights. As an adopted person, I campaigned for a long time for adopted people to have a right to our birth certs, which thankfully has now happened, but I brought forward legislation to change that back in 2015. And it got through the Seanad with unanimous support, and never there was it wasn't time for it to get through the Dáil before the election. So I know exactly what it's like to be part of a campaign. We've worked really, really hard to get the support in the first place for the change to be made. You get it halfway there. And then, as you said earlier, Cathy, as soon as election is called, it's just guillotined and that's it. And you start from scratch. And then sadly, I wasn't there after the election to restart it. So you're relying again. You know, I do believe that Roderick O'Gorman wants to change this. And
I
believe in his good faith. Mm. But you're relying on who he may or may not be in that position after the next general election. So you're explaining, you're starting from scratch again and explaining to a new minister, potentially new officials, why it needs to be changed and starting all over again. And again, that's just not right when this is a real issue that's causing heartbreak for women and their families right now.
Now, Avril, you think, with your insider knowledge, that the process of changing the legislation would be relatively simple. The precedent is already there from the Paternity Leave and Benefit Act in 2016.
Yeah.
Is it easy? I mean, are we simplifying that a bit?
No, look, things can be done when there's a will, right? So, you know, if it's funny in politics, things are complicated and then other things get done in the middle of the night, you know, when something happens, particularly economic issues, you know, when something happens and you have to set the banking system overnight, you can save it. You know what I mean? I think it does come down to priorities. And in fairness as well to the minister, I think he's in a particularly difficult department. So Minister is Roderick O'Gorman, who has the Department of Children, Equality, Immigration and Youth. There are so many complicated different issues in there. So that's why as well, look, we have offered to go off and privately get legislation draft up if that's helpful. You know, we're really stepping up here and saying, let us help you. We appreciate that there are lots of difficult and different issues going on there. But we just need to see some steps put in place to actually make this happen, to make it a priority.
Okay, so you are making it easy for him. I mean, Roderick O'Gorman has a lot on his plate, as we know.
He does, and I can only empathise with that. You know, like he hasn't and wouldn't have anticipated, you know, the huge work that he's had to put in terms of rehoming people coming from Ukraine and all of that. Like, they're enormously difficult.
Never mind being thrown under the bus over the amendments.
So that is why we really do want to help.
Avril, we're doing this at a particular time, both of you, because Daffodil Day is coming up soon. It's next week. Avril, it's a big day in the calendar of the Irish Cancer Society. So you're asking communities to come out in force. How will that work in practice? What do you hope to see?
What we hope to see is people coming together all across Ireland, in every town, village, rural area across Ireland, and painting their local communities yellow. By buying daffodil pins, running coffee mornings, there'll be people doing dips in the cold March ocean. There'll be all kinds of activity going on. And that's really important because it's important for us because it raises vital funds to support all of our work. And it also gives hope to people going through cancer to see somebody wearing a pin, to see their community rallying around to help them. I mean, every 3 minutes, somebody in Ireland hears the words, "You've got cancer." That's how common cancer is. And in fact, one in two of us will get that diagnosis in our lifetime. And I know that there will be other people, sadly, listening, Cathy, to this podcast, who've been there, who've either heard those words themselves or been given that news about their parent or their partner or even their child. You know, so anybody who's been affected by cancer knows how tough that is, the fear and anxiety that diagnosis brings, the physical, emotional and financial impact of cancer, and indeed the lasting effects, like Emmett mentioned, things like infertility, incontinence and fatigue. Like, cancer stays with people for a long time after diagnosis, and we help with all of that. So thanks to the amazing support that we get from the public, we have free counselling, night nursing, transport, peer support, information and advice.
Now, just slow down there, because I think only 5% of your income comes from the government. Is that correct? So if I say, I mean, I've had cancer, so I must say I'm full of empathy, Emma, as anybody would be, but your particular case is egregious. If, say, tomorrow I were to sort of say to you, Avril, ring you and say, my friend Avril, what can you do for me? I am lost. I don't know where I'm going with this. I feel I have support around me, but I don't feel it's informed support. What would you say to me? So what do you offer?
You would call us on 1-800-200-700. So we have a free phone number, and that is staffed by cancer specialist nurses. So the nurse would talk to you, would listen to your story, understand your personal circumstances. So understand, you know, your age, whether you have young family to care for, whether you're older, whether you have support or not. You know, cancer doesn't care whether you're an adult or a child. It doesn't care if you've got amazing family support or if you're on your own. So we would listen and understand what's going on for you, what's causing you the greatest anxiety, and how can we help? So is that you need to peer support, that you need to talk to somebody else who's been through cancer to understand how they got through it and have that emotional support? Do you need a free lift? Do you need us to pick you up at your house and bring you to your chemotherapy appointments and bring you back home again? Because transport is a challenge. You know, it's particularly a challenge in rural areas, but it's also a challenge in urban areas.
I was going to say, that applies to rural areas, yeah?
Yeah.
People who live in really isolated rural areas, so you can still have.
Last year, we actually increased the number of drives done by our driver service by 30% in 1 year. So I think that's probably, it's a lot to do with the cost of living crisis and what people are experiencing financially. But we did over 22,000 drives. That's individual drives with one of our drivers picking someone up from their house, bringing them to the hospital, waiting while they got their chemotherapy and bringing them home. And all of that is funded by fundraising. We've provided counselling sessions to cancer support centres around the country, peer support, our night nursing service. So sadly, while more people are surviving cancer, 9,000 people still die of it every year. So we have a free night nursing service where our nurses will go in and look after people at end of life so they can spend their final days at home, where they want to be, in their own home and surrounded by their own, you know, their own comforts, their family. And we're the only organisation that provides that. So if it wasn't for that, people would have to stay in hospital, or they wouldn't be able to come home. And all of that is powered by fundraising. As you said, we only get 5% of our funding from the state. So we have to raise over 25 million euro every year to fund all of that and to fund our life-saving research. And Daftal Day next week, 22nd of March, Friday week, is when we hope to raise about 5 million of that. So we're reliant. So at this point, a week before, we get very stressed about the weather, and I'm checking it every hour on my phone. But it's when, you know, we're really hoping that next Friday, that people will come out and show that really powerful support for those that are going through cancer in their community, and so make sure that nobody has to go through it alone.
And that very visible part of Daffodil Day, Avril, where people, including relatives of mine, sit outside supermarkets and things behind a desk and chatting up people and saying, give me money. is that all arranged now? Or do people still need to ring and volunteer?
I mean, it's never too late to volunteer. If somebody wants to get out and sell pins for us, they can call us and we'll set that up. If you want, it's not too late to bake some buns and organise a coffee morning in your house or your workplace. What I will say is that we have thousands of volunteers across the country. Like, there's not a village in Ireland where you won't see people selling pins. And that's because our team, our Yellow Army, have been working on this since last year's Daftal Day, literally the day after, planning this, doing their list, planning out their locations, talking to, you know, the manager of their local supermarket and making sure that they can collect outside, getting their team together, doing the rosters. Enormous amount of work goes in. And that is because there isn't a family in Ireland that hasn't been affected by cancer. So there are just so many of us that know what it's like, and that know how important it is both to have those services so that nobody has to go through cancer alone, but also to have that sign of hope and that sign of solidarity.
Well,
is really important.
I'm looking at Emma, and she's such a sign of hope. you're doing very well, Emma.
Absolutely, yeah, super. Back at work full time, like the normal everyday problems of a mother of two children trying to work 5 days, and it's really a thing of the past for me. Like, I don't think about it really that much at all anymore. Rory is absolutely perfect. Like, he is wrecking our heads and our house, like a normal almost 3-year-old. Like, it's super. But when it comes to something like this, like Daffodil Day, like, I'm so willing to step back into all of that to support them, because the work they do is amazing, you know. And I was at the Daffodil Day launch a couple of weeks ago in Croke Park, and what an amazing morning, like full of so much hope. Like, We laughed so much. We heard some amazing stories, and you know, the work that the Irish Cancer Society does, it's so much more than I would have ever thought, even while I was going through cancer. It's only now afterwards that I've really come to understand, like, the amount of work they do, and that so little of it comes from the government. Like, it's powered by the generosity of Irish people, and a huge portion of that comes from Daffodil Day. And it's such a it's a big day in our culture. Like, everyone has a pin on. It's like amazing. So I'm just so thrilled to be part of it, and to help out any way I can, you know.
Well, it wouldn't be happening without people like you, and indeed Avril, who's a powerful advocate. And Emma, the very best of luck with everything you do. And Avril, good luck next week.
Thank you.
I hope it will be a massive triumph.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming to the Women's Podcast this morning. Go back to the sun. That's it for today. Thanks again to our guests, Emma McGuinness and Avril Power, and of course to Tilly Cripwell, who joined us earlier. The best of luck to both of these really important campaigns. If you enjoy this episode and the podcast in general, please leave us a review or subscribe, as it really makes a difference to us. I'm Cathy Sheridan, and this podcast was produced by Suzanne Brennan and Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. You can reach us on social at IT Women's Podcast, or email us on thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. That's it from me. Mind yourselves, and I'll talk to you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.